This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up in our left-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Senator Cree Deeds shared his perspectives on issues facing Virginians at a Senior Statesman of Virginia event held September 10, 2008, at the Northside Library in Albemarle County. Senator Deeds is seeking the Democratic nomination for governor. Following his opening statement, questions were taken from members of the audience. Senator Deeds began his comments by reminding us that to compete in the 21st century, we must be willing to take chances and to be entrepreneurial in our approach. Senator Deeds.
If we are going to compete in the 21st century, we've got to be willing to take chances and be entrepreneurial in our approach to developing ideas and economies that are going to make sense for us in the 21st century. I think it has to happen. It has to happen here. You know, and it has to happen here because we don't have any choice. What are we going to do? Are we just going to die? We're going to die eventually anyway, but we have to create an economy that makes sense for us here now. It's like this energy thing. Another interesting guy I met, and also a guy that's a little bit further in Henry County. He's in Bassett. He grows canola. Now, you all have been to the grocery store. You've seen the canola oil. It's just like corn oil or anything else you cook with. It's a substitute. Well, he grows canola, and he doesn't turn it into cooking oil. He turns it into a mixture, a higher grade oil that he mixes with petroleum to form biodiesel. And he's got a pretty neat operation because while he grows the canola in North Carolina, he brings it to a refinery in Henry County, and next to that refinery is a gas station. So it's all, he controls the process. It's integrated completely, but he's also controlling the market. He's got the market for it right there. Now, here's the thing. You know, this. Can you all hear me without that?
We're on the podcast.
Oh, okay. I apologize. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sometimes just the sound of it annoys me. It's just so. We're going to run out of gas. We're going to run out of petroleum. And it's going to happen sooner than any of us thinks, be my guess. There's an energy economist in Northern Virginia I know, another interesting guy I've met along this trail, who told me back in the summer, you know, that within a year's time, diesel fuel is going to be unavailable for anything but commercial purposes. And it's not going to be unavailable because the government makes it unavailable. It's going to be unavailable as a matter of market economics. We're just not going to have the supply of it. When they get a barrel of oil, they generally refine two-thirds of it into gasoline, one-third of it into diesel fuel. Where the demand for gas is unbelievable, the demand for diesel fuel, particularly with the development of China, the Chinese economy, the demand for diesel fuel is just going through the sky. Anyway, my wife, you know, with one little girl I have left at home, is the terror of the Southwest Virginia Hunter Jumper Association. Pam takes her to horse shows about every weekend, and she drives a F-250, a Ford pickup truck, diesel. This summer, she was paying as much as $4.89 for a gallon of diesel fuel. Well, prices are down a little bit now, down almost a dollar on that. Within a year's time, it's going to be the prices are going to be much, much more if you can get it at all for that sort of purpose. So we have to develop alternatives. You know, and I will tell you this: we're going into this winter. What the price of heating fuel is going to be, I don't have any idea. I've got a friend, another interesting fellow I've met, who's in the heating oil business in Lynchburg, Virginia, and he tells me who's making the money. He claims he's not. But the heating fuel, we're going to have a crisis this winter if we have a hard winter, because the price is just going to be more than a whole lot of people can bear. In the short term, the only way we can have an effect on the price or supply of fuel of any kind is conservation. We're just going to have to figure out more efficient ways to heat, more efficient ways to use fuel. We're going to have to figure out better ways to get around and shorten our trips and figure out ways to make rooms warmer, make things last longer. Reuse, recycle. We're just going to have to be better about that. But in the long term, that conservation alone is not going to move our economy all the way forward. We're going to have to develop alternative sources of fuel. You know, this guy and Bassett, you know, he's on to something. Using canola for biodiesel, and they mix it with petroleum product. He's on to something, but that alone is not it either. They're multiples. There are multiple answers out there. There's no single thing that's going to allow us to figure out what our energy future is going to look like. We're going to have to develop alternative sources of fuel through green technology. We're going to have to through green plants, switchgrass, canola, any fibrous material. But we're also going to have to develop wind technology. We're going to have to develop solar technology. We're going to have to learn to take advantage of the tide. I think that a lot of the technologies that need to be developed can be developed right here. And I think, to tell you the truth, I think we can make a buck doing it. We can build a whole economy, and it can happen right here. And I don't think what I'm saying is that radical or that big of an idea. I think it's going to happen. It's just a question of where it happens, and it's just a question of whether we lead or follow. I say we lead. Virginia's always been a leader. I say we lead. If we develop the technologies here, we also reap the economic benefit. We also develop the jobs and the businesses that are around that research. I think, you know, it's not going to be cheap and it's not going to be easy, but we have to figure out how to develop the research capacities, completely develop the research capacities of our universities. We've never taken advantage of that. We have, you know, in Virginia and Virginia Tech, we have two of the top public universities in the country, in William & Mary. We have some of the, and JMU, we have so many great universities. With Virginia and Virginia Tech in particular, we have the research capacity that's untapped, in my view, and can be tapped to help us find our energy future. That's part of it. But the other part is what you hear a lot of people say, that government's not the answer. Well, government, in my view, isn't the answer. It isn't the whole answer in any respect. We've got to figure out ways that will incentivize the private sector to come to Virginia and to do this research in Virginia. And I think we use our tax policies to do that. We make sure we have the best facilities in the world, best facilities, best work, smartest workforce in the world right here. We can do that, and I think that's going to be a big part of our energy future and a big part of our economic future. So, what else is going on out there? Well, we've got a transportation dilemma in Virginia too. There's a fellow that represents Danville, who got in some trouble back in the spring when he said in a public meeting that other places have transportation problems. Danville doesn't. And the paper took him to task on that. The paper said Danville's in a void. We don't have a problem. Everybody else in Virginia does. We don't. I remember I was having a town hall meeting a year and a half ago, and I was talking about transportation and talking about the needs around the Commonwealth. And I had a fellow stand up in the back of the room at the end of the meeting and said, "Senator Deeds, I'm real proud of everything you're going to do for Northern Virginia and Virginia Beach. But what are you going to do for us?" And I guess that's the real dilemma of politics. You know, what are you going to do for us? But the three answers, I guess, to that statement, that question. Number one, we're a commonwealth. Now, legally, there's no difference between a commonwealth and a state. We could be the state of Virginia, and legally it's the same thing. But I think commonwealth is a great metaphor for the common condition we're all in. If one part is sick, if one part has a problem, we all have a responsibility to fix it. That's really the way we assure ourselves that we're going to have help in our time of need. And right now, I will tell you, the two cash cows of Virginia, the two areas of Virginia that are supporting everything else, or Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. That's where the majority of the tax revenue that feeds every aspect of state service comes from. And they're in a big jam, both of those areas. But the second thing I said, you know, besides we're a commonwealth, the second thing is just relates to that. It's part of that. If you expect to ever build the transportation infrastructure that's needed to support economic growth in Central and Southwest and Southside Virginia, a lot of that revenue is going to come from Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. If we aren't there when they need us, where will they be when our time comes? They're not going to be there either. You know, what we have to do, we have to figure a way, in my view, to double the rail capacity between here, between Charlottesville and Washington. We've got to figure a way to complete four-laning of 58 through Carroll County and Patrick County in South Side of Virginia. We've got to figure out a way to construct the Coalfield Expressway, which will basically connect Kentucky to West Virginia through Southwest Virginia. That will mean unbelievable economic opportunities are opened up in that section of Virginia. We've got to figure out how to stop the carnage on Interstate 81. We've got big problems around this state, not just the Northern Virginia or Hampton Roads, but here's what we know about those areas. If there's a hurricane, or if there is September 11th type attack against our military facilities or the port of Virginia, you've got 1 million people in Southampton Roads that you're not going to be able to get out. We all have a responsibility there. Everything in Hampton Roads is over water, over or under. The traffic there, part of the interesting things of this journey I've been on is just being all over Virginia. The traffic in Northern in Hampton Roads is just unpredictable. You know, certain times of the day, you know there's going to be a problem. But you can have a flare-up anytime because you got these choke points. Everything's over or underwater. Northern Virginia is just unbelievable. You know, and in this day and time in politics, a lot of folks talk about family values, and they talk about politics. Government should support traditional family values. Well, I grew up in the country. I grew up going to the Presbyterian Church in Millbrae Springs, and I've got pretty much traditional values. I'm sometimes criticized for that. But I will tell you this. There's nothing to support traditional family values with a government that allows people to sit in traffic for an hour and a half more a day than anybody else in the state. And people in Northern Virginia have to do that. An hour and a half every single day to and from work. That's an hour and a half they could be spending having dinner with their spouse, an hour and a half they could be coaching their Little League's their kids' Little League baseball team, an hour and a half they could be given to their church or synagogue or civic organization or community. You know, I would argue that if we talk about family values, we need to practice what we preach. And the first way we practice that is we fix our transportation system. Northern Virginia is the site of the worst traffic jam east of Los Angeles, twice a day. We've got an obligation to fix that. And then I would argue, you know, that was my second point when I was asked that question. My third point is this. Even if you don't buy into this notion that we're a commonwealth, even if you don't buy into this notion that if we're going to get their help, we've got to help them, well, you've got to understand this. And this goes back to something else I said. The funding formulas that feed education and transportation and every other aspect of state services, police departments, health departments, they're fed by tax revenue that comes from all over the state of Virginia. You know, when the dollars flow in from Stafford County, they don't segregate that in a pile and say, we're going to send that all back to Stafford County. It goes into a formula. Right now, Fairfax County, for example, is 14% of the state's population. They pay 28% of the state's income tax collections. You know, if you add up Loudoun and Prince William, Arlington, Alexandria, you're over 50%. You're over 40-some percent. If you don't support economic growth in those areas, you're cutting off your own nose despite your face. You know, you're not supporting your own institutions. We all work together. I think that the next governor of Virginia is not only going to have the responsibility of fixing the transportation situation, but of creating opportunity in every corner of the state. You know, I don't think it's healthy at all that we have two areas that prosper, Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, and then you've got this spot in Central Virginia called Charlottesville that prospers, and then you have so much of Virginia that doesn't prosper. Go to Cumberland County, go to Page County, go to Highland. Beautiful places, not much opportunity. The next governor of Virginia, I think, is going to have a responsibility to reach out and create opportunity in every corner of the state. And I think there's some ways you can work, ways you can do that too, but it's not going to be easy. Not going to be easy. You know, you got this. The governorship of Virginia is interesting because you only have 48 months. You're not subject to re-election. Requires you to have focus and drive and not waste a single drop of that. 48 months, it runs out pretty quick. And what we found out, all of these guys, I've worked now with five governors, and I will tell you that every one of the five of them, when they get to that fourth year, they're wistful because they realize, I'm a lame duck now, baby, and I'm not getting anything done. I better not take on any controversial issues because we're just going to run out of steam this year. And the problem, that's part of the problem that our current governors had working with the legislature. The legislature, the folks in the control, the House of Delegates, the Republican leadership over there has, most issues are not left or right or Democrat or Republican. It's about Virginia. It's about moving forward Virginia. You don't want to create prosperity just for the Democrats or just for the Republicans. You want everybody to move forward. But the folks that control the House of Delegates have been controlled by the fact that 17 of their folks voted for Mark Warner's tax plan in 2004. They think they created a superstar, and they don't want to do that for Tim Kaine. Well, you know, the news for them is this. Mark Warner was a superstar before that. Mark Warner, is capable of doing things. That 17 of their guys did the right thing. That meant that was good government. Politics should not get in the way of good government. Right now, I'm all over the state now. I'm doing this gubernatorial campaign. It's about all I'm doing, I'm doing a lot of traveling. So it's interesting. It's fun. I'm getting a great education about Virginia. Where are we right now? Well, we're in an economic downturn. Is it recession? I hope not. I mean, it certainly looks pretty bleak to me, but I hope that we're going to pull out of this before long. Where we are right now, though, is in this position similar at the governmental level to where we were in 1991 and in 2001. We are, in a position where we have to have choices to make about everything, every aspect of service the state government provides. Do you raise money? Do you raise new money? Well, it's hard to raise taxes when you nobody likes to raise taxes, and it's hard to raise taxes at all when people aren't making more money. The economy's bad, and incomes, it's a pretty scary time. In this journey I've been on, I'll just give you an example. Last week I was talking to a guy who manages residential real estate, rental property in Hampton Roads. And he told me two things that were disturbing. Number one, they rent apartments on a year-to-year basis. And they encourage people at the end of the first year to get into the second, get into another, to re-up, do another year's lease. But more and more people are paying a premium of $20 a month so they can keep a month-to-month lease instead of a year-to-year. Now, what that suggests is that people are doing month-to-month because they're not certain about their jobs. They're not certain that they're going to be able to be there for a year. They're not certain where they're going to be or that they're going to have the same jobs or be in the same location. That's number one. But number two was a little more problematic. Rental of apartments. More and more people are using credit cards to pay rent. Now, everybody knows, and I know people get in tight spots sometimes, but when you are using a credit card to pay your rent, that is a sign that there's something bigger out there that you're not going to be able to take care of. Credit cards, I don't know what the interest rates are, 24, 36% or whatever. That's pretty dangerous. So we're in a tough time right now at the state. This past year, Governor Kaine presented a budget that was $72 billion over 2 years. That's general fund, non-general fund. And a lot of people will scare the daylights out of folks and tell them how much the budget's grown. But and that might make sense on at first blush until you realize that every time UVA raises the tuition, which they've been doing on a pretty regular basis, that increases the size of the state budget. Every time the state agency that collects child support does a better job of collecting that support on a monthly basis, that increases the size of the state budget. Those are non-general funds. The General Assembly doesn't control the way that money's spent. If we collect money to pay child support, it goes back out to the custodial parent. But because a state agency's doing that work, it's considered non-general fund. So, you know, we have Governor Kane presented, I think, $72 billion two-year budget. Because the economy continued to experience some difficulty during this General Assembly session, we slashed the size of that proposal from $72 billion to $71 billion. We've gone through some cuts since then. The governor last week asked all state agencies to prepare for cuts that would range from 5 to 15%. Yesterday, the governor... the governor's secretary of finance made presentations to the money committees and suggested that the situation is pretty bleak, at least for now, that we are struggling with our tax collections, just aren't keeping up with projections. This morning, the governor's council of economists was meeting to try to figure out where we are and what projections make sense for us. I would guess that we're going to end up with budget cuts in the range for just about every agency of around 10%. And every indication I've seen suggests that our economy is going to continue to struggle for the next 14 or 15 months. But I don't want that to be a scare. I'm not trying to scare anybody. We'll bounce out of this. You know, I saw something. I've been doing practicing law for 24 years. And I spent a lot of those years doing bank work, working, helping close loans, helping people when they were buying property or setting up a business, acquiring real estate. And about 3 years ago, a product developed in the financial market, maybe 5 years ago, I don't know, about 5 years ago, I think, that I saw as problematic. People were all of a sudden had the ability to borrow 120% of a home's value and make payments of interest only. Now, that to me was a sign like using the credit card to pay your rent. That's a sign that things of that nature are just not going to last that long. You know, it's like that old Sunday school song about building your house on stone or on sand. That sand washes away pretty quick. And when you're building your financial house on a 120% loan when you repay your interest only, that's problematic. I would suggest that part of what we're going through right now is just a corrective process for that. And we will get through this. People, there will be some pain, and we're, you know, we've got to try to alleviate that pain wherever we can. But we're going to get through this, and by the first quarter of 2010, things are going to be better and looking up. Maybe even hopefully by the second half of 2009, things are going to look up. The American people are resilient, and even when we went through the Great Depression, we didn't give up. And this is far cry from that. This is just a speed bump. We'll get it figured out. But it is a tough time, and I just ask you, read the paper. Let me know what you think. Whenever you're concerned about an aspect of state service. Please let me know. Please let me know what you think. But we're going through a period of cuts. It's a matter of priority. I had a fellow tell me, you know, they didn't want their taxes to increase. Yesterday, when I was yesterday at this farm, you know, I was trying to figure out, because another guy that I think is really interesting, this fellow in Charlottesville here, took $1,000, and 34 years later started a business with $1,000. Never borrowed any money along the way. I wish I could say that. 34 years later, he has $300 million in sales. in a business in Charlottesville, a homegrown business. What a fantastic story. He says, part of this process of running for governor, traveling the state, meeting all kinds of fascinating people, he said you've got to be about creating a culture of entrepreneurship. People who are willing to take chances and create something new and create opportunities for people. So yesterday when I was at this tilapia farm, this hatchery, I said, well, what do you think state government can do to help your business grow, to help us grow businesses like this in Virginia? He said, I can tell you what you got to have to stop doing. You're going to have to stop cutting the research budget at Virginia Tech. He said, that's really where you help my business. You help them because you're investing in research there, and they're helping us to develop better way to do this business. And I said, well, you know, there are only two ways to get money for that. One is taxes, and two is tuition. He said, well, you know, I'm convinced that if people think the money is going to be spent on education, they'll be willing to pay more in taxes. Well, I don't know if that's so or not. I don't know if that's so or not, but it's interesting out there. Somebody else said, you know, we just want you to make it cheaper for my child to go to school. Cut tuition. You know, I've got two tuition payments now. And I can tell you I want it to be cheaper too. But we really have to be about figuring out ways to allow more people to have access to public education, to higher education. And that means we need to figure out a way to make it more affordable. And we've got a lot of work to figure that one out, frankly. This is going to be a tough time. You know, it's all about priorities. You know, if you're concerned about budget cuts here or budget cuts there, I want to know about it, but I also want to know, if we don't make those cuts, where do you suggest we cut? Or how do you suggest we get the money? Because it's easy to come up and say, this is not right, but help me figure out another way of doing it. Because we're going to go through a tough time in state government. But we'll get through it. I'm convinced of that. I've rambled for a while, and I'd be glad to take your questions. I'd really rather spend more time hearing what you want to talk about.
I'd like to just take one at a time. We've got some microphones that we're going to come around. And I just ask you to ask a single question. At a time and keep your questions fairly concise so everybody will get an opportunity.
Hi, I'm Mel Moore. You just mentioned that we'd get through this mortgage crisis quickly, maybe next year or the year after. Are you speaking just for Virginia? Because it looks like to me, on a nationwide basis, it's got a long, long ways to go.
Well, I wasn't speaking specifically about mortgage. I was speaking in general about the economy. I think the economy will pick up by the first quarter of 2010. The mortgage crisis is very deep. You know, at the federal level, they've been considering some legislation, and frankly, we'll see how it goes. It's such a complex issue. This past session, I introduced probably the most comprehensive mortgage reform legislation that was ever introduced. And one of the components of that bill, and you'll be astounded at this, one of the components said you can't commit fraud in the application process. You know, I didn't think it could do that anyway. But the mortgage brokers, that lobby, fought me tooth and nail. And I had a big comprehensive bill, and I couldn't get anybody to talk to me about it. I couldn't get any of the lobbyists to talk to me about it. And finally, I set up a meeting at 7:30 one morning in my office, and I had these four lobbyists, these silk suit guys, nice people, all of them. But I had them all in my office, and I said, okay, you've seen this bill. I agree that it's pretty bold. What can you live with in this bill? And they said, well, Creed, we don't think we have to live with any of it. And so from that meeting, you know, I'm a guy who wants to sit everybody around the table and try to figure things out. From that meeting, I took that bill and I scaled it back to about four elements, one of which was this fraud thing. this prohibition against fraud. And the lobbyist, the chief lobbyist for the mortgage brokers, was heard in the committee when I submitted the bill. He was heard saying to one of the other lobbyists, "You expect me now to argue in favor of fraud?" But you know what? That's what he did. And that's not the worst part of it. That's not the worst part of it. He did. The worst part of it is he won. He won with the committee. You know, I got most of the Democratic votes, not all the Democratic votes. All the Republican votes were on his side. But the mortgage crisis, another one of the things I've learned along the way, it's very interesting. Prince William County is the mortgage crisis center of Virginia. They've had the foreclosure center of Virginia. Prince William County, Manassas, and Manassas Park are three of the top four or five localities in the state that have had, in terms of percentage of homes in foreclosure. The development in the Culpeper area, and so I know you all travel on 29. Culpeper, you've seen more and more development along 29 over the last, you know, I've represented Charlottesville since 2001, December of 2001, and even in that 7 years' time, I've noticed unbelievable amounts of development up on 29. The development in Culpeper is directly connected to the economic welfare of Prince William County, because up until $4 a gallon gasoline and foreclosures in Prince William County, people couldn't afford to live in Prince William. They bought in Culpeper. And so the housing market developed in Culpeper around that. But now, all of a sudden, with $4 gasoline and with houses in foreclosure in Prince William, housing developments in Culpeper have gone into bankruptcy. So it's a complex issue, and it's connected to the foreclosure last week. You know, when you're calling people up to ask them for money, you got to figure out interesting things to talk to them about. So this guy last week that is in the property management business, I was talking to him basically to kind of feel him out on the mortgage issue in Hampton Roads to see how it was. They've got in some areas of Hampton Roads, they've got a pretty transient community, a lot of military families in and out, and I wanted to find out what his perspective on the foreclosure issue was, and that's when he's the one that told me about using the credit cards for rent, and I don't think that part of the credit crisis crisis is a strong word. I don't think the foreclosure crisis has hit any area of the state like it's hit Prince William County, and I agree with you that we are a long way from climbing out of that hole. The legislation I had at the state level was mirrored legislation that's passed in North Carolina, that's passed in Minnesota, some states have been a little more aggressive than we've been substantially more aggressive than we've been. But there's legislation now pending at the federal level, and we'll wait and see how far it goes.
I understand in Virginia, the last figures I saw on it, University of Virginia is getting about 15% of its support from the state government. I don't know whether that's correct or not, but it's what I've read. That's been a number of years ago. And how can you cut further and still say it's a state university?
Right now it's about 7%. 7%. That's an excellent question. We had legislation in the General Assembly, I think in the 2004 and 2005 sessions, that basically allowed Virginia Tech and William & Mary to privatize many of their functions, or at least to be free of state bureaucratic hindrances, I guess, with respect to the way they manage some of their property, and with respect to tuition, to a certain extent, as long and the justification for that bill, frankly, was the failure of the state to adequately support our fine institutions. Think about it this way: if University of Virginia is the flagship of our system, and I understand some people will disagree, and Chapel Hill is the flagship of the North Carolina system. North Carolina spends $2 in general fund money, general tax money, per student at Chapel Hill for every dollar we spend per student at UVA. I think we have a serious reexamination process that we need to go through with respect to the relationship between the state and our system of higher education. There's no question about it. And that doesn't just, and that's not just something I've been thinking about since I've had all these tuitions to pay. We have a real problem. We have a problem that right now I think is results or it's evidenced in the fact that because the state does not support institutions like UVA, UVA has to continue to increase tuition. And the tuition, I mean, it's hard enough to get into UVA or now, but if a child can get into UVA, if a young person can get into UVA, they ought to be able to go. They ought to be able to go there. The other states have looked at it in different ways, and one, I was having dinner 3 or 4 weeks ago with a member of the UVA Board of Visitors, and he looks at it kind of from an interesting standpoint. And this, frankly, has been the standpoint of a number of people who have worked in higher education in the administration of higher education and have served on boards of visitors in the past. What he said to me is this. He said, you know, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, they can set whatever tuition they want. Not everybody can get in there. But if you get into one of those schools, you're going to pay whatever the market allows them to charge. What a place like Harvard has done is they've taken that extra tuition money they've gotten, and they've put it back over into scholarships. And so if you might pay $45,000 to go to Harvard, but if you come from a family that makes less than $100,000 a year, you don't pay anything. If you come from a family that makes less than $200,000 a year, you don't pay much. You know, the market, that's the argument that he used. He said, why not allow UVA to have that freedom to set market-based tuition? I mean, it's an interesting idea. It's one that I'm not naturally inclined to. I'm not really crazy about it. I have been more of the view that we ought to have tuition as low as possible. But here's the other side, especially with respect to Virginia, William & Mary, Virginia Tech, increasingly with respect to JMU, George Mason. A lot of these schools have become so exclusive that the kids that can get in those schools are the kids who have all the family support in the world. They go to the best high schools anyway. The public system of higher education exists so we can create a middle class, so we can lift people up and allow them to live the American dream. And I don't know that we're really doing that anymore at some of these schools. I think what we're doing is we essentially have a, because of our funding issue, and because they've done such a good job of providing education over the years, and they are exclusive. We've created a private public system. We have a public system. There are institutions out there that are doing the job of the public system, that are lifting people up, that are creating opportunities that where they didn't exist before. But at another level, we have a private system almost. We're educating kids who are already have it made. There were lots of them born on second or third base, and they think they've had big hits.
I was wondering what your reaction would be to the speculation that Terry McAuliffe is going to enter the gubernatorial race.
Doesn't change a thing about what I feel like I need to do. Terry McAuliffe, I've met him, and I'm sure he is a fine individual, very knowledgeable. He certainly knows the political process, and he knows how all this process works. You know, for me, I believe that there are things I need to do. I think that one of those is to run for governor right now. And I think I've spent 17 years in the legislature. I know the process. I know the people. I think I've got a good case to make, and I'm going to make it. If he wants to get in, I welcome the opportunity to debate him on the issues, and I'd welcome him to the trail. I don't know anything about his background, but I've heard him say that he was born in Syracuse, New York. He's lived in McLean for, I think I read, 17 years in Fairfax County. So I think that's where he is. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
I have more of a comment, and this is on transportation. And I I'm finding that it's very hard to get from Charlottesville to other areas. And about a week ago, I went to North Carolina, and I used Greyhound. And it took me about 6 hours to get to North Carolina. And I had to do one change in Withville. And the only bus I could get out of Charlottesville was a 120 bus, which put me in North Carolina at 8:30 at night. Now, that same bus coming back to Charlottesville, I got to the bus station at 11:25, and I got home to Charlottesville at 10 o'clock at night. I went so many places that I had never gone before. South Boston, Virginia, Farmville, passing all these places to get me to Richmond. Then I had a layover in Richmond for 3 hours before I got home. And I was worn out when I got home.
That's nuts. You know, when I was in law school, I went to law school in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My wife is from Beckley, and she, of course, my job was to do as well as I could at school. Her job was doing multiple things to keep us fed while I was down there. I'd come home for Christmas a little bit before her after exams, and I'd take a bus to Withville and then catch it to come up 81 to Stanton or Lexington, and then I'd hitchhike or somebody would come get me. So I understand a little bit about that, but what we have to do in the long run or in the short run is figure out how to move more people and freight by rail. I tried to get a couple of years ago, Meredith Richards has been a big advocate of this over the years in Charlottesville. A couple of years ago, I tried to get the state to invest a little money in doubling the rail service, to double the rail service between Charlottesville and Washington, because I got an idea that you'd take an awful lot of pressure off of 29 if you could put more people on rail. The problem with rail, though, is that the railroads own the tracks, and their priority is moving freight. It's not moving people. So we've got a lot of talking to do. Now, I'll tell you, over a year ago, I sat down with the folks, the Norfolk Southern guys down in Norfolk, and kind of sketched out where high-speed rail would go, because rail lines would go in Virginia. This is not something I can accomplish in 4 years as governor. But if you want to talk about something that revolutionizes the economy of this state, you have Virginia's population centers connected with high-speed rail. You turn, for example, a trip from Christiansburg to Tyson's Corner from a five-hour drive to an hour and 15-minute commute. You change the way people live. You change the way our economy functions. We have to do a better job of mass transit. We have to, that's going to be one of the big lessons of this energy problem we've got now. We've got to figure out ways to move more people and people and things places in bigger chunks as quickly as possible. Part of it's train, part of it's also buses. Buses are going to have a role, just like, there are lots of people I know who would like to get every tractor trailer they could off the highway. But I can tell you this, it's not going to happen. As long as there's short haul trucking, trucks are going to be on the highway. They're going to serve a very valuable function. Well, buses serve a function too. There's been a real decline of that mode of transportation. When I was a kid, the only way I ever got anywhere was if somebody would take me to a Greyhound station in Lexington or in Stanton. I mean, I remember one time when I was a kid, you got on a train in Goshen, and you go from Goshen, Virginia to Newport News, right at old CNO. But mostly I was a bus to relatives in Washington or bus to relatives in Richmond, or somewhere like that. That's how. But it's hard to get bus lines anymore, and we've got to do a better job. We've got to figure it out.
Yes. Straighten me out on one question.
You're not on the podcast.
Straighten me out on one thing I heard you say, and that was about Danville, that they don't have a problem.
No, they have a problem. But their legislator, their delegate said, we don't have a problem. What their legislator said in a public meeting, that their member of the House of Delegates said in a public meeting, the transportation problems really in Hampton Roads, Northern Virginia, we don't have a problem in Danville. Now, the paper took him to the mat, and they said, where you been? You know, how are we ever going to experience the economic growth we have to have if we don't build this transportation infrastructure? And how, aside from that, if we have the infrastructure we need, if we're not team players with the rest of the state, how can we ever expect to get the things we need here? So that was attributed to a fellow named Danny Marshall, who was in the House of Delegates from Danville. Danville has real needs. They've done a good job with respect to some things, but they've got real needs in that area. So I wasn't saying.
I must have misheard you.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Dennis Grushon. Two subjects of interest I wish you would comment on if you care to. If you've read the book Fair Tax, and also Term Limits, both for state and federal. I would be interested in anything you would have to say.
I've not read the book Fair Tax. You know, I've not read it. In Virginia, you know, our income tax is one of the lowest. You know, 5 3/4 is the high rate, and so we have a pretty much a flat tax already in Virginia. Term limits are an interesting concept. In states where they have strict term limits, you know, the only term limit we have in Virginia is the governor, 4 years. In states where they have term limits, I would argue that the power really shifts from the people who are elected to the unelected government, the permanent government, legislative services, legislative staffs, and the lobbyists. Term limits, you know, I would argue that the best term limit is at the polls, is at the election. You know, that would be my view anyway. I mean, people disagree, and I've changed my mind about the subject several times over the years. But I just, in the states where I know there are strict limits, people are in or out after 6 years or 8 years or 12 years, it's difficult to build up much continuity in work. And the people who end up with the real power are the permanent staffs at legislative services and the long-term lobbyists, because there's no term limit there.
Move to the national scene for just a minute.
Sure, Dan.
I'd be interested in what do you think the prognosis is Virginia having a chance of going Democratic this time?
Well it's interesting. Virginia, you know, a lot of people have said that, you know, have talked about Virginia. And they talked about 1964, the last time a Democrat won in Virginia. But think even go back further than that, because Virginia was part of the Solid South through 1948. When Strom Thurmond ran as a Dixiecrat in 60, beyond that, 1952 and 1956, Virginia was part of a handful of southern states that voted for Eisenhower. In 1960, Virginia voted for Nixon. 64, Virginia voted for Lyndon Johnson only because Harry Byrd loved Lyndon Johnson. So Virginia has been a pretty solidly Republican state at the national level for 50-some years, I would argue. There's something going on out there that you know is difficult to really put your hands around. I think that Virginia's in play in this election cycle. I don't think you know anybody who talks about how Democratic Virginia has become hasn't spent any time at all campaigning in Stafford County, or Fauquier, or Frederick, or Shenandoah, or Page, or Rockingham, or Augusta, or Hanover, or Chesterfield, or Cumberland, or Grayson, or Wythe, or Smith. I mean, God bless America. There are so many places in Virginia that are really tough for Democrats to win in, but something is going on out there. And part of it has to do with the way this economy is functioning. The economy, people are really hurting. This foreclosure crisis, people are losing their houses. People are losing their jobs. Something is going on, and people want change. Now, will that change result in them voting for Barack Obama, voting for a Democratic candidate for president? I don't know. But I can tell you this, that in my lifetime, a Democratic candidate for president has never had 38 offices in Virginia. A Democratic candidate for president has never had 90 paid staff people on the ground in Virginia. But this presidential candidate does. So I think it's in play. I think it's going to be tough. And if I were betting, I'm not sure what I'd do. But I think that Barack Obama's got a real legitimate shot this year. And honestly, I think that there are some people that will say, well, you know, race is a big issue, an unspoken of issue in some parts of the state, and maybe that's so. But even in tough places in Virginia, people are struggling economically. They're struggling with things. They want change. Now, who will be the change agent this year? I don't know. But I think that Obama's got a chance.
Jim, let the lady in blue dress answer the next question because I cut her off last time and she happens to be my wife.
Creed, the AAP said earlier, like in April, that there were 20 states that had budget problems. And of those 20 states, they said three had structural problems, that the revenues always were less than the cost or the disbursements. Of those three, one of them was Virginia. So what can you say about what our structural revenue problems are and budget problems?
Where was that? I mean, I think I saw the headline, but where was that report from?
It was AP, and it had 20 different ones. California had the greatest budget shortfall. Virginia and Michigan and one other state had structural problems.
Well, I would argue that we have a budget problem. Lots of states have budget problems, but I don't think we have a structural problem. Well, we've got, I mean, there are a number of things that I look at in our, the way we deliver services that need improvement. There are a number of things that structurally need to be changed, but in our overall budgetary structure, I don't see a structural problem. We're having a problem. And when they argue that our we always spend more than we take in, that's just absolutely not false. That's not absolutely not true. We've got a constitution that says we have to balance the budget. We've got a constitution that says we have to balance the budget, and we balance the budget every year in my lifetime. I mean, and the only time that a balanced budget was not passed, when Jim Gilmore's last year in office, 2001, and even though the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion, they couldn't agree on a budget. That was the only time that we failed to have a balanced budget passed. So we pass a balanced budget every year. Governing Magazine said last year we were the best managed state in the country. This year we're tied with Utah. We're among the best managed states in the country. I disagree very much that there's a structural problem in our budget process. There are a number of problems in the way we do government, I think, but I don't think that's one of them.
Given the number of miles you must have accumulated on your car driving just your district, has that convinced you that this gerrymandering foolishness needs to come to an end?
That's a great question. And here, you know, anybody who can devise a way for me to drive from one end of this district to the other, stay on a road, on a publicly maintained or even privately maintained road, and stay in the district the whole time, I mean, I will clean your house by myself with a toothbrush. It can't be done. To drive from one end of the district to the other, I have to spend time in a district represented by someone else. It's nuts. I didn't need that to be convinced, though. I've driven, since 2002, I've introduced legislation to the past 6 years to change the redistricting process to make it nonpartisan. But legislation like that has been introduced, similar to that, has been introduced since 1978. Ken Plum, from Northern Virginia, a Democrat from Northern Virginia, introduced the legislation the first time. Now, last year, all those years it's been introduced, last year I introduced it for the fifth time, and I got it out of committee for the first time ever. And then I got it passed the Senate for the first time ever. And the way I did it And you know, even though the Republicans controlled the Senate last year, I went to Ken Stolle, a Republican from Virginia Beach, and I said, Ken, you know, you ought to believe in this, you know. And he read it, and he agreed to vote for it. Then I went to my friend Russ Potts. You know, Russ Potts, as you may recall, ran for governor a couple years ago, really the Don Quixote of Virginia politics in many respects. And I said, Russ, it's me. You know, this is my bill. I care about this. You know, Russ became my biggest hero, my biggest advocate. So I got it out of committee, and I got it on the floor of the Senate. Well, the Democrats only had 17 seats in the Senate, and I was not assured that I was going to get all the votes, the Democratic votes there. Dick Sassol hates the bill, and Yvonne Miller does not like the bill. Some folks believe that to the victor belongs the spoils. You know, I'm elected. I get to draw the lines the way I want. And so, but I got all the Democratic votes in the end. But I went to John Chichester. I went to Perry Blevins. I went to different Republicans that I've had good friendships with. And I said, this is the right thing. You know, it's the right thing. I got it out of the Senate, was killed in the House. Same thing this year. But it was interesting because when it got out of the Senate this year with 33 votes, got it over to the House, and they killed it in a subcommittee on a 3-2 vote, 3 Republicans to 2 Democrats. But that's not the big news. The big news is all 5 people in that subcommittee were products of a system that does not encourage competition in the electoral process. All 5 people, 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats, had been reelected the fall before without opposition. In all 5 of those districts, turnout in the election was between 11% and 18%. You know, when there's no choices, when there aren't any choices, why vote? That's what the people in those election districts decided. You know, when you've got a district that's designed to elect Democrats or Republicans and not give people a real choice, that's a threat to the whole system, the whole Republican system of government we have. That's your real term limits issue. I mean, you got to figure out first to make the districts fair. The bill I've had is kind of a marrying up of ideas. There's 17 states that have one form of nonpartisan redistricting or another. The bill I have marries up the commission, basically, that the New Jersey plan produces to the criteria for redistricting that the Iowa bill has. The criteria from Iowa is pretty revolutionary. It says in redistricting, the only thing you can consider is population. Other than that, you keep districts compact, contiguous, and you keep communities of interest together. It says specifically, you can't consider where incumbents live, you can't consider where candidates live, you can't consider past performance, political performance of areas, you can't consider party registration, you can consider nothing but population. Now, the result of that bill in Iowa, because that, you know, everything in the world looks good on paper, but you want to know how it works. The result in Iowa is that they've got 6 congressional districts there. Every one of those races, the winner gets less than 55% of the vote. Every one of those races, you have real choices at the election. You know, and that's what it's about. It's about the competition of ideas at the marketplace. The marketplace is the ballot box. You shouldn't be afraid of competition. When I had that bill last year, and I got it out of the Senate, Stuart Connick, who some of you all might know, Stuart Connick, lobbies now for UVA. He was Secretary of Finance for John Dalton, Secretary of Finance for Chuck Robb, Democrats and Republicans. He just knows government. He came up and touched me on the elbow at a cocktail party and said, you know, a lot of people around here don't understand it, but that's the most important bill down here because it will change everything. If you have nonpartisan redistricting, if you have fairness in the electoral process, more people will turn out to vote, more people will participate, you will have more competition in the elections, and you will produce a legislature that's focused on solving problems, not on partisanship. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's lots of great speeches out in Denver a couple weeks ago, and I hope everybody got a chance to listen to them. Lots of great speeches. That guy Brian Schweitzer is just unbelievable. The governor of Montana is just the funniest guy in the world. He really is. But the speech Mark Warner made, maybe a little understated, but you know, it's not all about left or right. It's not all about Democratic or Republican. It's about the future against the past. It's about moving forward. You can't just talk to Democrats or just talk to Republicans. You have to talk to everybody. It has to be about Virginia. It has to be about America. You know, And that the nonpartisan reform, I'm so committed to it because and a lot of my Democratic friends aren't going to be happy with it because when I'm governor, I can make it happen. I'm convinced that I'm willing to throw myself out there on the marketplace and have a competitive environment. That's fine with me. I think it'll produce a legislature focused on solving problems and focused on taking us forward. Unless you won't have this partisanship that eats us up sometimes.
There's a professor down at the University of North Carolina who was notorious for challenging the districting in that state, mainly over odd-shaped districts that were made in order to capture a black, made it possible for a black candidate to win in that area. And he continually won before the Supreme Court. And then the legislature would be given so many months that they could redistrict, or the Supreme Court would draw the lines, for the state Supreme Court would draw the lines. So the legislature always came through and made them a little more compact. And it occurs to me that there would be districts where the minority party would be such that they would have as much right to claim discrimination as a black, claiming that they have no chance to win in that district, and that it should be made more contiguous and that, so that they would have a chance at a win. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you know of any case similar to that where anyone has claimed that, you know, the district isn't fair because of the way it was
designed. I do not, but your point is valid. And it's pretty interesting. And this is probably way more detail than most people are interested in. But in the 80s, the Reagan and Bush Justice Departments operated under the principle that if you could create a minority-majority district, you had to do it. And so states used that as an excuse to create these really weird-looking districts in the 90-91 redistricting to draw these minority-majority districts. And some of them, particularly North Carolina and Georgia, they were thrown out. You could make the same sort of argument in a whole lot of districts in Virginia, that Republicans don't have it fair in certain districts, that Democrats don't have it fair in certain districts. But the courts in general have always said, you know, we're going to stay out of those issues. They're political in nature, and the courts are not going to take up disputes between political parties. They're just going to stay out of politics. That's a long standing view of courts that emanates from a decision. You know, I wish I could tell you, but it's ancient. So they're going to stay out of disputes between parties. But when it comes to race, particularly in the South, you know, here's the issue you got to get over on their nonpartisan redistricting. You know, we are a Voting Rights Act state. We have, you know, don't have a great tradition of supporting voting rights of a whole lot of Virginians. So we're held to a different set of scrutinies than other states. Mississippi has a nonpartisan redistricting commission. They're the only Voting Rights Act state that does. So we can learn some lessons from some of the things they've done. They're the only one of the 17 that's a Voting Rights Act state. So there are things we can learn. I'll tell you, one of the districts in Virginia, you look at the district I represent, you know, it looks like a barbell, a bent barbell. In a Bath and Allegheny, this bent bar through Rockbridge County jumps the Blue Ridge to Nelson, then down into northern Buckingham, and then back up into the eastern two-thirds of Albemarle County plus Charlottesville. It's pretty I don't think there's a district in Virginia today that better illustrates the obscenity of the law that allows the creation of districts like this. I live 85 miles west of Charlottesville. 75% of the people I represent live east of the Blue Ridge Mountains. I live not in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I live in the Allegheny Mountains. I live on the other side of the Shenandoah Valley. You know, you talk about communities of interest, I cut through three or four of them. But maybe there's one that's a little bit worse. There's a district in the Richmond area that's drawn from East Richmond through Henrico County, through Charles City County, then it crosses the James River to pick up two precincts in the city of Hopewell. It's nuts. You know, we can do better.
We have time. one more question.
We have another question. I'd like to get your opinion on the possibility of the good and maybe extending the 2-year terms of our General Assembly representatives and our House of Representatives. Would it be a benefit if they could have longer terms and not be running for office every other year?
When you're in the House of Delegates, you're never more than a year away from a campaign or an election. There have been bills introduced in the past to extend the House of Delegates term out to 4 years, and they haven't gone anywhere. And I believe it keeps you closer to the people. When you know you have to return to the people for re-election, if that's what you choose, every 2 years. You know, I guess there's some. The point you make is that the people ought to be able to relax for a little bit, and they ought to they can get real work done. And for a lot of them, that makes sense. But there are a lot of people there. The 2 years is too much time. You know, and you want them to be back before the public within 2 years to be held accountable for what they do or for what they don't do. And so I can understand. I've got a good friend in the House of Delegates who has introduced bills like that in the past, and it's gotten he really believes in it. He believes that you he's committed to this notion that you can get more done in 4 years than you can in two. And I don't doubt that. I don't doubt him at all. But I just when I was in the House of Delegates, I didn't mind running every 2 years. I knew that it kept me on my toes and made me have to respond to people. And if I wasn't responsive, I knew I'd get flushed out. Now, I've been in the Senate now for 7 years, and the Senate has a 4-year term, but I've never really had advantage. I've always, it was a special election in 2001, then the regular election in 2003. I ran for Attorney General in 2005, and then I ran for re-election to the Senate in 2007. I'm running for governor now, so I've never really had a 4-year term. Not since I was Commonwealth Attorney in Bath County, anyway. Thank you all very much.
Well, Senator Deeds, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to have you here, and we appreciate that. Was a great presentation. Appreciate it.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.